Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star's Olive Garden, I'm Larry Larson. I'll be your server tonight. Can I get you started with some appetizers or a drink?
Breadsticks, please.
Yeah, and then, of course, this is Gov Maharaj. That's the correct pronunciation, right?
Sure.
All right. And we are in our new temp studio. This is a small little office, a loud little office off of a server room in the old MSNBC building.
Which is all that we could apparently afford.
Yeah, it's the nicest walk-in closet I think Microsoft has to offer. We're feeling a little close to everything here, but we're good. We'll make it work.
Yeah, I don't think that the HVAC system is designed for a room like this.
No, I don't think it was made to support this much power draw
right.
or this much heat in one room. So
it's like I'm looking around and I'm seeing overloaded circuits all over the place.
You heard nothing. Yeah, and if I start pitting out, will this open the door or something? That's all right. Well, let's get started. And by the way, we'll be in here until the second week of January, so sorry about that. We'll just have to deal with it. All right, from Terry, wondering if you could help me figure out an issue with the brand new Surface Pro 2. Windows said it was going to perform a firmware update, and it did this without issue, and it installed in about 10 minutes. It installed about 10 updates. But now it throws a BSOD with the error power driver state failure. It appears to happen when the Surface is on battery power, and I've not used it for a few minutes. I know that the Wi-Fi connection seems to stop working and disappear.
Yeah, so this is actually a known issue. It's getting fixed. It's affecting just a limited number of the Surface Pro 2s. And there's an easy workaround. If you go into power options, you go to your balanced and change plan settings, and then change advanced power settings. You go down to wireless adapter settings, power saving mode, and switch both of them. I only have a Surface Pro original. I don't have a 2.
Yeah.
Change it to maximum performance for both of them.
Okay.
And that will prevent this particular failure until we push out an update, which hopefully by the time you see the show will actually have arrived.
Okay, and Terry did say that fixed it, so good job there. All right, from Robert, I've been struggling with Bluetooth and Windows 8.1 on a Lenovo laptop. When the laptop starts up, it works great. All Bluetooth drivers work. But after 15 minutes, the Bluetooth disappears. It's not in the device manager on Windows 8.1 charms menu. It's totally gone. I tried restarting services, running the troubleshooter, but Bluetooth isn't there. I've upgraded drivers and disabled all the power management settings in the drivers. The only solution is to reboot. Is there a PowerShell command to enable Bluetooth? And is there a way to disable power management in sleep mode? The two things are causing me problems.
At this point, I can't actually say for certain that it is power management. I don't know why it's disappearing at 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I asked for a DXDAG. I got that. I'm going to try and repro it on any of our Lenovos, but hunting our bug database, we actually haven't found anything that's related to this.
Yeah.
If this was an upgraded system, the first thing that I would try is, this goes for basically any kind of troubleshooting, for an upgraded system where you don't want to actually nuke it and start from scratch again, mm-hmm. Is just install a fresh version on a VHD.
Okay.
So boot from VHD on that system. We'll at least see whether or not it happens with a clean install. And also, I would go back and ensure that he has the Bluetooth drivers from Lenovo's site specific to that machine.
Okay.
Undo those power changes that you've made because, you know, it may actually be interfering, and I don't actually know what settings has been changed on that system. So for an upgraded system, even for a clean install, install the Bluetooth drivers that came from the OEM site.
Okay, good. From Mike, I'm trying to reduce the number of rows on the start screen. I've added the layout maximum row count registry entry as described in multiple online articles, none of which from us, I bet.
Nope,
none of which from us. I had used this in Windows 8 and it worked perfect. In fact, it's working on my laptop running Windows 8.1. I cannot get it to work on my desktop. Is there another setting I need to adjust in conjunction with this registry entry? Are there other steps I can try? Your first question was why?
Yeah,
I was. It's aesthetics. You want to go from six rows to four.
What you can do, and I don't know if my system will show this, is if you bring up the charms bar when you're on the start screen and you go to settings and you go to tiles, show more tiles might be set to on. So in 8.1, we've changed the heuristics a little bit in order to match how much free space you have visually on your start screen based on the screen size. And this is heuristic, so it's supposed to take more advantage of space as it's there, which is why you're seeing the six
rows.
Looks
at your monitor size.
And your DPI settings to give the most consistent layout possible, as well as for layout roaming. Mm-hmm. So in 8.1, we have start screen layout roaming across multiple machines. And in fact, the reason, if you've modified this registry, it actually shouldn't make any difference on the 8.1 system. He's saying that he's done it on his desktop or laptop.
Yeah.
Because that registry value is gone. It's an undocumented registry key. It's been changed in 8.1, so there's something else that's affecting that particular system to get it down from 6 to 4 rows. So because it's been undocumented, we have no reason to keep it around. We had to change it in order to do the start street layout roaming.
Yeah.
So there isn't currently a way to manually force it to go from 6 to 4.
Okay.
Is the end result.
All right. From Matthew, hello. I just wanted to ask a question about the lock screen on Windows 8 8.1. Sometimes from sleep or cold boot on Surface Pro and RT, lock screen keyboard will not show up and I have to restart the tablet. I don't have an external keyboard, just a mouse. It's done this even with Windows 8.
I'd want to make sure that it has all of the latest updates installed. And for the lock screen, especially on the RT, the first generation RT, it would come up if you touch the screen once, or if you waited for a few seconds. Usually, especially coming out of the cold boot, it's waiting for some service to start up.
Would it be possible that if you had a mouse and keyboard set that had one dongle, that dongle would make the computer think there's a mouse on it, or is that not possible?
Sorry, say that again?
If you have one dongle that's for a mouse and a keyboard, like I have for my device I got at home, I forget what, some Logitech keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
But would it detect from having that dongle? Because even though I don't use that keyboard, I use the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
If I have the dongle in
actually,
there,
actually, that could easily cause that to happen. Yes, okay. I hadn't even thought of that
possibility. All right, from Pedro, just got my new Surface 2 yesterday. Loving it. Have a minor issue. I'm hoping you can help me with. I bought a new touch cover for it. The problem is that I don't really like the keyboard clicking sound when typing. So I went into PC settings, PC and devices, typing under the touch keyboard settings, changed play key sounds as I typed to off. This does not appear to have an effect, and it seems to only apply the on-screen keyboard. How do I change it for the touch cover? Well, that setting should do it for the touch cover, and it wasn't. And so I sent him instructions to do exactly what he'd just done.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's not the problem you said.
It's a syncing issue.
I was amazed. I was like, how do you know that?
Keyboard
noises coming up. Oh, that's a syncing issue.
Well, it's not a syncing issue between the keyboard and the computer.
Yeah.
It's the SkyDrive setting syncing issue, and we're going to be pushing out a fix for that.
Okay. All right. Next question from Robert, and the way you knew that was you've probably seen it before.
We've seen it before.
Seen it before. All right. From Robert, I have a Windows 8.
Most people never turn it off.
Yeah.
Right? So right now I've got the type keyboard attached to this.
Yeah.
I've got a different Surface that has the touch keyboard attached.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never turned off the sounds because I actually need to have the sounds to make sure that what I'm typing has been registered.
Yeah.
Right? So the number of people historically that turn off those sounds are relatively few, or what they do is they just turn down the volume, which would affect it the same way.
Okay. From Robert, I have a Windows 8.1 and use Visual Studio every day for my profession. I've noticed a Netflix app will not play back video on my desktop machine. I've done some searching around and found that the problem is Hyper-V. I've installed it as part of Windows Phone 8 SDK. It also seems like it can't just be disabled, but actually has to be uninstalled. If I remove it, then Netflix app works again. I suspect this affects DRM video playback in Windows RT, or WinRT in general, but this is pretty much the only app I'm using. I've heard a lot of speculation. It could also be a problem with the video drivers in Hyper-V. I have an ATI graphics card.
Yep, blame AMD. They turned this particular feature on. There's a lot of different features that you can implement for DRM.
Yeah.
And AMD has implemented one particular feature that says when you have Hyper-V running, that DRM content cannot be played. If you switch to an NVIDIA card, it would work. If you switch to Intel, it would work. If and until AMD updates their video driver to no longer require this, you either have to use IE for Netflix, which actually is kind of interesting because in 8.1, IE has some major updates when it comes to Netflix, and its Super HD and buffering issues have been greatly reduced. The Super improved. HD part has been, greatly improved, and buffering issues have been reduced. So, yes, that's basically all that you can do at this point is to use IE. If you're running it with Hyper-V and you can't use the Netflix app.
All right, well, at least you got a solution there.
Yeah.
Next question. I have a network of mostly Windows 7 machines, and I also use Spiceworks, and sometimes it doesn't detect when software application has been removed because some leftover registry remnants are still present after the uninstall. Is there a way that I can scan PCs in my network and clean up the registries on each one in an automated fashion? Well, there's a couple things I wanted to ask you about. Is first of all, cleaning the registry. Something that you do?
Never do.
Yeah.
For one, it is not usually necessary. Actually, there's a number of different reasons for this. Registry cleaners became very popular in XP timeframe because there were so many different types of installers out there, and a lot of people, or a lot of installers just didn't do a good job on the uninstall. So registry cleaners came about, and supposedly all was right with the world. As time went on, however, the number of installers have actually come way down. They've become a lot more monolithic. You have Install Shield, you have MSI or Windows Installer, you have other technologies that are more packaged, like Steam, for example. You know, they are in and of themselves an installer technology. So the number of different types of installers have come way down. So, and they've also become much more improved. When they remove something off the system, they actually do clean up properly. It's actually very, very few applications, uninstallers, that don't clean up properly. The issue with registry cleaners is that unless they are really, like, just phenomenal, I've not actually come across one that truly is phenomenal, they tend to do more harm than good. They will delete something that they think is not being used when it is in fact could be used, is actually changing a setting on your system, or is a plug-in into your system in a particular way that will then break in a weird way.
Or if it was written for Windows 7, there might be huge differences in 8.1.
That so if you take a registry cleaner that was designed on a particular OS, and in fact we've seen this. There's this came up during our preview, and it's in fact happening even now in 8.1, where certain registry cleaners are breaking modern or Windows Store apps because they're deleting registry keys, they're modifying the registry in a particular way because they don't recognize it.
And then people blame the app.
Well, no, people blame Windows.
If
they just blamed the app, that would be great. So the OS and the actual uninstaller for the application knows what's best.
So what's the downside if you go to uninstall something that leaves some remnants behind, that it's still there? I mean, you might have an icon in your in a menu, or you might...
Then delete the icon specifically,
exactly.
Right?
But most is there of the time, anything that would cause problems for the computer?
I can't say no,
right?
Because if you have... It really depends on the application. It depends on what you had installed.
What happened.
If you uninstall it and there's a particular thing that has modified the system in a particular way. Take, for example, an errant shell extension. So you install an application, it installs a shell extension, you uninstall it, it doesn't uninstall the shell extension, but it leaves the registry information for that shell extension in place, but the DLL is not present, so you could get a crash. You could, or it only leaves part of the registry entries in place, and you get a crash. So yes, you can absolutely have weirdnesses for things that don't uninstall correctly. But the number of things that don't uninstall correctly is greatly reduced. The other thing to do would be to actually contact the vendor of the software that doesn't uninstall correctly. We have a logo program for this. If you get Windows logoed, you have to run the application verifier. And that actually checks to see if you've done the right things during an uninstall. it doesn't go through and make sure that every last bit of registry entries have been removed, because sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
Applications can install common components, some of which cannot be rightfully uninstalled because there could be other dependencies, or you know, you've wanted to make a permanent change to the system and you don't necessarily need the binaries for that change to stay in place. So there's lots of different reasons why there may be remnants after something has been uninstalled, not all of which are bad.
Okay, and to the original question, he's got a lot of different machines and wants to clean them up all in an automated fashion. Do you even have a suggestion there? Or
I mean, sure. It depends on what it is that you're trying to remove. If you know exactly what has been left over, then you know you can create a PowerShell script to go and clean it up. What you can also do is run a system restore.
You might say run all those systems for a little while, see what problems you have, if any. If you have a problem, you can make a script that'll fix all of them for that. But you probably won't have a problem.
More than likely, you won't have a problem. I mean, I've run different machines for many, many years after installing and uninstalling stuff, and frankly, I've not had the same types of issues that many people have historically had on XP, where you have, you know, system slowdown, you have oddities that arise. I mean, seriously, I've run Windows 7 now because I've had development machines on it since 2006.
Yeah.
That I have not actually reinstalled. So,
yeah, and I've seen in probably Windows 7 time frame, I've had like where I'd uninstall an app and it'd still show up in, you know, programs and features, or you know, it might still have a directory, and I'm sure there's some registry queues, but I haven't had any problems from it. So
yeah, usually the biggest problems that I've ever had from things that don't uninstall properly are things like AV software.
Yeah.
In which case, most of them have a very particular cleaner utility designed for that software, and that is what I would run. You know, and again, that's usually the biggest problem that I've ever seen. Is
the biggest problem I've seen is when I would go to install a big codec pack or something for videos, and then you're just may as well. my pain. You know what I'm talking about.
No, the fact that you installed a codec pack.
Yeah.
Not recently.
I mean, these were back
awful.
In the old days. When
awful,
you had to do
awful.
That. All right, next question.
You hurt me.
Is there a way that I'm able to increase the range of Wi-Fi using my 25 dBi Yagi antenna and Alpha AWS-036H Wi-Fi adapter without buying another antenna? Is there anything like an amp that'll make it go farther? Well, yeah, I mean, there's something kind of like that. I got a Newegg link here that I can show you. So this is one device that I saw that looks similar to what the person is describing, something that I almost bought a couple times. It gets really good reviews on Newegg, so I'm kind of wanting to make the leap, hoping that it will extend the range to the other side of my house. But we were talking about this earlier, and this might not be the best way to do this anyway.
I mean, I admit I've looked at the same thing before because I've liked the ability to set this router up on its own on the touchscreen itself. The problem with most repeaters, and this extender repeater are essentially the same thing, is depending on how you go about the repeater, it can half your bandwidth on a particular band, and you have to do it right, quote unquote right, is you use something called WDS, Wireless Distribution System, with two of the same type routers that communicate with each other and forward the packets, and they're dedicated. It's a dedicated link between the two, which is why your bandwidth gets halved. Range extender is a little bit different. It acts as a Wi-Fi client that then translates it to another Wi-Fi network. So it essentially, you create a new Wi-Fi network that you can connect to that will talk to this repeater, and it will talk to your original network and pass the packets along. You get significantly increased latency. So if you are doing online gaming, for example, you probably don't want to be on the side of this link. If you're watching movies, you should be fine. But anything that has, you know, that would impact
anything with latency, like video chat,
right?
Anything.
Well, honestly, wherever this person is, I'd run a cable, mm-hmm. right, and then have another dedicated Wi-Fi router there.
Yeah.
So you can have your Wi-Fi router connected via cable to your main router, mm-hmm. as opposed to doing an extender.
Okay, yeah, and one of the things I was going to do at home was just, my Wi-Fi is on one side of my house, so the mm-hmm. opposite side of the house, of course, has
the weakest.
Some issues, yeah, mm-hmm. trying to connect. So I'm just going to run the cable to my Wi-Fi router and put it in the center of my house,
yep.
and just run all the cables back, you know, into my office, and hopefully that will take care of that and mm-hmm. just centralize the Wi-Fi access point.
I mean, if you're going to run cable anyways,
yeah.
then it's not a bad idea to have multiple Wi-Fi access points, because
yeah.
then you're actually reducing the load on each access point,
true.
Right? And you're getting a more dedicated link. So if you have, say, two or three Wi-Fi access points all connected via cable to a main router,
mm-hmm.
you're reducing the load overall on your network.
Yeah.
That would be my ultimate recommendation, especially like for a lot of things nowadays, you just can't use wired everywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of tablets, right? There's yeah. no Ethernet adapter.
Yeah.
So as opposed to overloading a single Wi-Fi router, I'd get multiple ones and then run cable to a really nice smart managed router and not a Roswell one. He gave me a funny look for those that are listening to the podcast.
Okay, pick of the week time. Pick of the week. And it's your choice.
This
what
one
do
is,
you got?
So my first pick of the week is called Wreck Image. A lot of people over the course of a few years have been asking the simplest way to create recovery images.
Yeah.
Not going back to what shipped on their system, but as a means of backup.
Yeah.
Right?
So I don't want to reinstall everything.
You don't want to reinstall everything. You don't want to reconfigure and recustomize everything. Mm-hmm. This tool will actually do that for you. It's nice and simple, nice UI interface, uses built-in tools that are in the OS, but makes it much prettier,
mm-hmm.
Lets you back up these images anywhere. It is extremely handy.
Nice.
So I would recommend people do
simple.
This. Nice and simple.
Good.
Anytime you get a brand new machine after you've installed all of the updates, because remember, when you buy something from an OEM, it may be sitting on a shelf for a couple of months,
yeah.
right? So it hasn't got all the updates. And it's a pain in the butt to constantly, if you're having to reset it to keep getting the updates, the same updates over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd periodically take an image that's good, and I keep two backup images, right?
Yeah.
So I keep an N and an N minus one.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just keep rotating them back, and
yeah.
you keep deleting your oldest image after you've, you know, made sure that your current one is nice and stable.
Mm-hmm.
You always have something to go back to. You have your N backup and your N minus one backup that you can always go back
and
to.
And this is how you can recover in 20 minutes.
This is how I can recover in 20 minutes.
All right. And your other pick of the week,
my
presentation.
So for previous shows, I think some folks have noticed my screen blank out
yeah.
Every now and again. And I keep forgetting, but there's a presentation setting in Windows. So there's the Mobility Center, which is, I think a lot of people have seen this
mm-hmm.
screen before. And you have, you know, presentation settings turn on and off, and I've got them turned on right now. But what a lot of people did not realize is that this setting itself can be managed. So if you go back and you go presentation, adjust settings before giving a presentation, you can actually set the volume. You can show a very particular background
nice.
If you want. So, you know, for a lot of people, I am not one of them, that customizes their desktop background, you know, family pictures and stuff like that. You can say immediately when you're going to the mobility center and saying presentation on, it'll switch your background to something more worthy of, you know, presenting maybe a corporate logo or
yeah.
whatever. And it can automatically set your volume as well. You know, maybe you automatically want it to mute.
Yeah.
This is extremely handy to fine-tune those mobility center settings.
Nice. All right. You ready for your check? Olive Garden reference.
Yeah.
All right. That's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. And leave comments in the show notes, but he wants the email so he can go back and forth
with you. I want the email.
All right. And we'll see you next week.
Take care. We'll be right back.